Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On New Year's Day, heists and capers, the European Union gets new leadership, and Jimi Hendrix and George Frideric Handel in the same piece. I kid you not. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From APM in Washington, I'm David Gura in for Kai Ryssdal. This is the Marketplace podcast for New Year's Day, January 1st, 2014. It's great to have you with us. We got some new figures this week on home prices. They're up in the Sun Belt states and in some big cities. Now, that might sound like a good thing, but it's not so great if you want to buy a house. According to Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer, we're starting to see some bidding wars in some markets.
Part of the reason housing prices have taken off, investors from other countries and Wall Street. They snapped up homes at bargain basement prices, then rented them out. All the investor interest sparked the bidding wars, which Anthony Sanders saw firsthand when he bid on a house in the Virginia suburbs of Washington several years ago.
I just happened to have one Chinese investor literally arrive at the house the same time I did, and we almost had a foot race to the door. Fortunately, I'm faster.
Sanders' fast footwork got him the house. Sanders knows a thing or two about the housing market. He teaches real estate finance at George Mason University. He says the bidding wars are producing bubbles in the hottest housing markets, places like Los Angeles, San Diego, Charlotte.
That's where the bubbles are forming. They're old bubble cities that are rebubbling.
Economist Svenja Gudell is watching those bubbles carefully. She's director of economic research at Zillow. Gudell says she doesn't see another big housing crash because lenders stopped making shaky loans and the bubbles are confined to the most expensive cities. Plus, she says more houses are on the market. Fewer people are underwater, that is, owing more than their houses are worth, so they're selling.
You have more banks selling their foreclosures, and you have more people freed from being underwater. So supply will increase.
Gudell says as the housing supply increases this year, prices will cool a bit, with home values up 3 to 5% in 2014, as opposed to 7% in 2013. Patrick Newport is a housing economist with IHS. He agrees prices won't go up as much this year.
And then a slowdown in 2015, and then going forward, prices growing maybe 1 or 2% above the rate of inflation.
Which Newport says is about the normal rate of growth, low enough to banish the bubbles and the bidding wars. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
By now, you've probably tossed the champagne bottles into the recycling bin, along with those party hats, and maybe you ate the last Christmas cookies for breakfast. Well, now it's all about getting sober and getting serious about your New Year's resolutions. We sent Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith out to get some tips from the experts on financial resolutions to find out the best way to get a handle on your money in 2014.
For years, David Welliver made financial resolutions, and for years, they didn't work.
I've made the wrong resolutions, to be honest, and that was I resolved to budget.
Which sounds reasonable. Welliver, who edits the blog Money Under 30, used to be more than $80,000 in debt. The problem, he says, was the same one people run into when they resolve to lose weight.
If you just say, I'm going to exercise more, I'm going to lose weight, you're bound to not succeed because those are very vague ideas.
Welliver was able to get rid of his debt by picking resolutions that were very specific and very achievable, like putting aside $50 a week. Now, if you want to get your finances in order, what's the first thing you should do? I asked Jill Schlesinger. She has more than a decade of experience in financial planning and is an analyst at CBS News.
Aim for zero consumer debt. That includes credit card and auto loans.
After that, take care of the basics. Make an emergency fund to last at least 6 months and bump up your retirement contributions. David Jones is the president of the Association of Independent Consumer Counseling Agencies. He has one major piece of financial advice.
Live beneath your means.
Jones says that can often be achieved by making small changes to your daily routine.
We see people every day that are having trouble making ends meet, yet they are going to Starbucks twice a day. They are buying lunches out when they could be brown bagging it.
Of course, a lot of us are suffering because the country went through a financial rough patch. So it seems only fair that Uncle Sam should have to make a financial resolution.
To have a regulatory regime that will prevent us from going through another financial crisis.
Jill Schlesinger says the most important thing the U.S. can do in 2014 is make sure 2008 never happens again.
It's very important when you have a year like we've just had to not gloat, but to look ahead and say, well, what could go wrong? And let's address that.
If 2013 was a good financial year for you, says Schlesinger, max out your retirement contributions and make a big emergency fund. Then go out to a really nice dinner. You can start your diet in February. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Wall Street was closed for the holiday, but don't worry, we'll have some New Year's numbers in just a bit. Greece takes over the presidency of the European Union today at a time when 27% of Greeks are out of work and the country is not winning the award for the most popular member of the EU. For the next 6 months, Greece will organize meetings and conferences. It gets to set policy priorities. And not surprisingly, Greek politicians say they want to focus on the economy and jobs. Mark Lowen is the BBC's Athens correspondent. He's on the line with us from the Greek capital. Hey there, Mark.
Hi, David.
I wanted to ask you first just about the mechanics of the EU presidency. This is a rotating thing.
Yeah, it's rotating. Every member of the European Union gets a six-month tenure at the helm of the EU presidency. But actually, things have changed a little bit in the last few years since the so-called Lisbon Treaty was voted through in 2009, which created the post of a permanent president. So, you know, the discussion will be led nominally by Greece, but actually the actual real power to change and shape and move policy is somewhat limited.
You know, 6 months, it strikes me, isn't that long a period of time, and it must be hard not only to convey one's agenda, but to drive that agenda as well when you only have so few months to do it.
It is, and bear in mind that the presidency EU can be one in which people say, oh, actually, they did that quite well, and Greece is hoping, really, that if there is a successful six-month presidency, perhaps that kind of bad blood that there's been between Greece and Brussels over the last few years of the financial crisis might ease a little bit.
We were talking just a few months ago about Greece exiting the Eurozone or being shown the exit from the Eurozone, I suppose. And I wonder just to what degree this is an opportunity for them. It sounds like a big one.
It is an opportunity, and we're no longer really talking about Grexit. In fact, the Greek Prime Minister likes to talk about Greekovery, which is another ugly phrase. But actually, that is not yet widely being felt, really, by ordinary people. They are still struggling with huge unemployment of 27%, with businesses closing, with one in four below the poverty line. It is far away from that kind of really bright light of recovery that it hopes will begin to shine soon.
Mark, because of the state of Greece, because of the state of the Greek economy, will this presidency look different or function differently than predecessors?
Well, it's talking about a Spartan six-month presidency. Even, David, check this, the traditional scarves and ties that are given as presents to visiting dignitaries have been scrapped because they were going to cost €147,000, about $220,000, and that's gone out the window. So that just shows you the incredible sacrifices that Greece is making for its presidency.
Are people there talking about, or are they excited about, again, regaining the spotlight that comes with this presidency?
Not really, no. It's really been very, very low profile here. And I'm actually even quite surprised by how few complaints they've been about the €50 million that the country is going to have to budget for the presidency. And that comes from various different types of budgets and pots. But there have not really been huge many voices saying we should just scrap it because we can't afford it.
Mark Lowen, the BBC's correspondent in Athens. Thank you very much, Mark.
Pleasure.
The Bay Area Rapid Transit System, known as BART, is the fifth largest rail system in the United States. And last year, BART employees went on strike twice, first in July, then again in October. Well, those strikes frustrated many Bay Area residents who had trouble getting to work, and some of the harshest complaints were on social media. Many of them came from workers in the tech sector. Well, back in July, Chrissy Clark from Marketplace's Wealth and Poverty Desk reported on that tension between frustrated techies were driving a booming economy in and around San Francisco, and the blue-collar workers who get them to their jobs. That tension says a whole lot about the changing nature of work in America.
During the BART strike back in July, I talked to a guy named Richard White. He's the CEO of a tech startup in San Francisco called User Voice. He'd been on Facebook grumbling about the traffic that had been unleashed on his staff. And here's what he said about the striking BART workers.
My solution would be to pay them whatever the hell they want, get them back to work, and then go figure out how to automate all their jobs.
When this idea went out on the radio, some cheered White on, but many found it offensive. A few threatened to stop using White software, which happens to automate parts of the customer service experience for business. I wondered if White had had any second thoughts. So I went to his office in downtown San Francisco recently to ask. It had all the requisite tech startup accessories, beer-filled fridge in the break room, air hockey.
The largest air hockey table we could get in the building.
In the conference room next door, we sat down to talk.
All right.
And White was quick to tell me that he probably did sound a little callous with that automation proposal.
Here's this, like, rich CEO He gets mildly inconvenienced, and he just says, let's just do away with all these people and replace them with robots.
He said, when you're thinking about technology all day,
sometimes you do have sociopathic tendencies. You do things kind of in a vacuum, right? The prototypical worker will be displaced by this. It's different than saying Claire over here will be displaced by that.
But that is what's going to happen to Claire, he said.
Eventually, these things are going to be automated. It's not just BART, but it's lots of jobs. My point was, we need to think about these things.
White thinks about them a lot, he tells me. As he moves through his day, going to work, doing errands, he can almost see technology eating up the world.
Everywhere I walk in San Francisco, I notice there's a job that I don't think will be there in 15 years.
And so we went for a walk down 2nd Street toward the BART station near his office.
All the tech companies are in this area for the most part.
On the way, a taxi driver cruised by in his cab. At least that's what I saw. For White, that's a future
self-driving car.
And that checkout clerk at the corner store that we pass by, soon enough, he'll be a
self-service kiosk.
In White's view, automation isn't just an inevitable thing, it's a good thing. We should take the routine jobs people do and
automate as much of their day as possible so they can have more time to do the more valuable things.
But as we move down the streets of the technology capital of America, looking at the world through tech utopia tinted glasses, there's this voice in my head.
Isn't this the kind of stuff that's been worrying so many of the economists I talk to? That as technology advances at a faster and faster pace, it's vaporizing a lot of the middle-class jobs that used to employ people without college degrees or super specialized skills.
By this point, back on the streets of San Francisco, Richard White and I had arrived at our destination.
So we're right at the entrance to the Montgomery BART station.
What makes this place so interesting is that BART has become something of an anomaly in the new economy. With so much automation across all kinds of American industries, the thousands of unionized jobs at BART are a rare breed today in that they don't require college degrees or super specialized skills, but still bring in a decent middle-class salary. Take that station agent in the glass booth.
Come for the emergency exit.
Helping someone figure out which train to get on. A job like hers makes an average base salary of $64,000 a year. BART workers say the strike is about making sure those good salaries stay good. But in Richard White's eyes,
that's a lot of money to pay someone to answer questions about how to get from point A to point B. I have a map in my pocket at all times to tell me that.
He pointed at the Google Map app on his smartphone, meaning that station agent job?
That's clearly a job that could be automated.
We watched the agent from a distance for a while.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
She was smiling and wishing her customers a good day.
Thank you. You're welcome.
At some point I asked White, so that whole automate her job thing, how do you feel about asking her how she would feel about it? He turned a little red.
Well, so she's such a nice lady, right?
Because I will probably afterwards ask her, but do you want to be
sure,
part of it?
Yeah,
okay. We went up to the booth.
Hi.
White was a little shy, so I explained to the agent behind the glass that the guy I'm with thought she seemed really nice, but also that a robot could probably do most of her job. What do you think about that?
I don't just sit here all day.
Her name was Lanice Landry, and at first she was a little defensive. But then she tried to reason with White, listed the stuff she does, helping people figure out the route maps, assisting the elderly.
A lot of people don't speak English either.
White nodded, but he wasn't convinced.
That makes sense a lot. I wonder if you have to be right here, right? If we could have, like, you could just work from home and you could actually just have a screen here and they ask you questions.
Honey, you're talking about way futuristic stuff. Come on now. I've been in customer service for about 10 years, and I do realize people don't read. Hi.
As if on cue, a frantic-looking lady with a suitcase ran up to the window and interrupted our little debate.
Hi, sorry.
Come on, honey.
Can you add money?
She was rushing to the airport and couldn't figure out the ticket machine. Landry came out of her booth to help.
Okay, so press yes.
And use your receipt for your records.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
Landry turned back to us and said, see?
Everything can be automated. And a lot of people do feel better having another person there.
But if your job was automated, I asked, what would you do?
I would do my hobby, which would be hair and makeup and buy and sell houses.
And now White is nodding.
See, wouldn't that be perfect if she actually could, like, pursue her hobby?
And yes, that would be very cool. But it's not what seems to be happening, at least yet. In studies that have tracked people over the last few decades who lost jobs because of automation or globalization, those people usually wound up with lower-paying jobs or no jobs at all. Some economists say it'll take time, but ultimately automation will be a net good in the future, just like it was in the Industrial Revolution. Others aren't so sure. Richard White says these questions trouble him, too. But he says those are the kinds of complicated challenges that a techie like him can't solve on his own. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Chrissy's story is on Marketplace's Best of 2013 podcast. That's a selection of Driveway moments from the past year, which you can download at marketplace.org. Just click on podcasts. Coming up, why do bank robbers rob banks? Because, as the saying goes, that's where the money is, or was.
It sort of gives you a sense of where the economy is going, and if you didn't know it was going online, now you know, because that's where people are stealing it from you.
But first, let's do the numbers. How about we look back on the year that was? The Dow Jones Industrial Average finished at 16,576. The blue chips packed on more than 26.5% in 2013. The NASDAQ ended at 4176, a yearly gain of 38.3%. And the S&P 500 wrapped up at 1848. That's 29.6% higher than last New Year's Day. What companies had a banner year? Let's start with Netflix, up 298%. Electronics retailer Best Buy charged up 237% this year, and electric car maker Tesla raced up 346%. Price of gold dug down 28% last year. The yield on the 10-year T-note, by the way, now sits at 3.02%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Have something to say about one of our stories or want to suggest your own? Find us on Twitter at MarketplaceAPM or join us on Facebook to interact with producers, reporters, and the hosts of Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday, January 2nd. Stock markets open back up for the first trading day of the new year. And there's a snow alert in much of the Northeast, so drive slow out there. Speaking of slow, President Richard Nixon limited highway speeds to 55 miles per hour back in 1974. Didn't last long. I'm Sitara Nieves. Keep those New Year's resolutions for at least one more day, okay?
This is Marketplace from APM. Happy New Year. I'm David Gura in for Kai Rizdahl. All right, how's this for an unlikely pairing? Jimi Hendrix and George Frideric Handel. Yes, they're both musicians, but I struggle to think of much else Hendrix and Handel had in common. Well, in the late 1960s, Hendrix rented a small attic apartment in central London, right next door to where Handel lived more than 200 years earlier. And soon, Handel and Hendrix will live in the same museum. Here's the BBC's Vincent Dowd.
It's a quirk of music history. For 36 years, George Frideric Handel lived in London at 25 Brook Street. It's probably where, in 1749, he wrote his famous Music for the Royal Fireworks. In the 1960s came a different sort of fireworks at number 23, next door.
Stand.
next to your fire.
Jimi Hendrix moved in 1968. Since then, the Handel House Museum has acquired both houses. Now, with the aid of a £1.2 million grant, there's to be a permanent museum to one of the great rock guitarists who died in 1970, aged 27. Ella Roberts of the Handel House Trust says the aim is
to recreate Hendrix's flat accurately and historically, the beds, the furniture, all the things that he would have known, but also to have a museum to explain Hendrix's legacy, the people that he knew and played with at that time in the 1960s.
But how do you know exactly what it looked like in 1968? Because some Hendrix fanatic is going to come and tell you if you get it wrong.
We're really lucky, actually. We got some fantastic photographs of Hendrix actually in the flat. So we do have a good reference point of what the bed looked like, the hangings, the chairs, the ornaments that you had around. And we know that Hendrix went to John Lewis to...
Which is a department store just around the corner.
And we do know that a lot of the furniture he had is still around.
The image of Jimi Hendrix being dragged around John Lewis checking out the electrical department and table linen is irresistible.
There must be some kind of way out of here, said a joker to the thief.
The new museum in London won't open for a year, though the Handel House Trust has already had a test run.
You've actually once or twice opened the space to Hendrix fans before, just very briefly. Are you hoping you might actually have people to come and actually look at both sides of the museum, so to speak, people who are both Hendrix fans and Handel fans?
Absolutely. I mean, I think from our response from a big exhibition we had a couple of years back, there's a lot of interaction and interest between Handel and Hendrix. We're quite confident that we'll be able to pique everyone's interest.
The Hendrix Museum won't be huge, just a small, rather hidden away attic flat converted. But to fans of hard rock, it will be a place of pilgrimage.
Tomorrow, or just the end of time.
The caper, the heist, well, they're alive and well in the internet age. Just last year, a hacker stole more than 4,000 bitcoins from the cloud, and you may remember thieves stole $50 million worth of diamonds in Belgium. They drove onto the tarmac at the airport in Brussels and, shall we say, intercepted a shipment. Tim Fernholz dutifully chronicled the biggest capers and heists of 2013. He's a reporter for Quartz, and he joins us now from our New York bureau. Happy New Year, Tim.
Happy New Year.
Well, I got to ask you, looking at this list, if you have a favorite heist or caper from the last year.
I'm very torn. I'm very torn because on one hand, they're all so good. But the Pappy Van Winkle's heist, the thievery of this $26,000 of artisanal whiskey hits near and dear to my heart as a lover of bourbon.
Hey, tell me about that one.
So it's a whiskey distillery in Kentucky. This is Pappy Van Winkle's 20-year-old aged bourbon, which of late in the United States has had this very big resurgence of popularity, $900 a bottle on the secondary market. And
wow.
Somebody stole cases and cases of this whiskey right out of the back of the distillery, have not been caught. There's a $10,000 reward out. I don't think it is going to be collected on.
You say you're torn. That was my favorite. So what's the other one you're torn between?
The other one that that was my favorite is the electronic ATM heist, where these hackers broke in electronically to some banks in the Middle East and rejiggered the account limits and made fake debit cards and sent thieves to cities all around the world to just empty out ATMs, because I think we've all had that dream where the ATM just is spitting out all of the money for us. And they did it to the tune of $54 million, which is
wow.
A really impressive bit of thievery, if you ask me.
And that was a heist that's pretty high-tech, and a number of these are, employing, sort of hacking, getting into computer systems. Just tell me how high-tech some of these heists are.
Well, I think it's definitely an indicator of where the money is now. You hear there's that classic quote where they ask the bank robber why he robs banks, and he says that's where the money is. The money is all on the internet now, and so a lot of these heists, the ATM one, the Bitcoin thievery, that's definitely one reason, aside from just the thrill of these brazen acts, to look at this is it sort of gives you a sense of where the economy is going. And if you didn't know it was going online, Maybe you missed that. Now you know, because that's where people are stealing it from you.
The dust still hasn't settled on the most recent heist on your list, and that is of 40 million credit card numbers stolen from Target. What can they learn from that heist and indeed from other ones that happened in the last year?
I think the first thing I hope they learn is sort of mitigation and preparation and really doing a better job of protecting their systems from these kinds of intrusions. But that's one thing they'll have to do. And I think the other thing that's worth thinking about from a consumer's point of view is how comfortable we are with big businesses collecting our personal data, because if it's not being collected, it's not there to be stolen.
Do you think that's sort of the future of heists and capers? It's going to be data. It's going to be information about credit cards, about bank accounts, things like that.
It certainly seems the way it's going. I mean, more and more the financial system is moving online. But, I think there's always going to have to be a human element involved, or at least maybe the more interesting ones will do that. That's why I like the ATM, because it's such a combination of something, you know, you could only do in this century and something you would have done last century, having guys with backpacks outside the bank collecting money. So it's a funny transition period we're in when it comes to big heists.
Tim Fernholz is a reporter for Quartz. You can find a link to his list of heists and capers from 2013 on our website. That's marketplace.org. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, David.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note along the lines of what we were just talking about, it comes from Bloomberg Businessweek. The FBI says criminals have found a new way to use stolen credit cards. They scale the roof of a store and wrap aluminum foil around antennas stores use to communicate with credit card companies. That foil blocks the transmission so stores can't verify whether a card is legit or stolen. And apparently businesses figure the connections down temporarily. They approve the transactions. By the time they realize what's really happened, the criminals are long gone and the stores are on the hook. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineer the program for us. I'm David Gura. We'll be back here tomorrow. This is APM.